bills on the agenda for today, and we are called into session. The House floor session, by the way, is at 10 a.m., so I'll be watching the clock on that. And this is a reminder for anybody who may not have heard this before, that beginning Monday, we will shift our starting time back to 8:30 instead of 8 o'clock. And, of course, even though the 8 o'clock official starting time is such that we end up spending 15 minutes making informal arrangements, we still will have an 8 o'clock starting time tomorrow. And for those who need to come in and have informal discussions starting Monday, I'm going to try to be here by 8:15, and I'm going to try to have us start pretty sharply at 8:30 on the official record. Of course, I've said that before, so some of us are not morning people. And in any event, we will be starting at 8:30 beginning Monday, but tomorrow we'll still start at 8. As to the list of bills that we have on the agenda, I will give folks an update as to a few of these so that you'll understand whether or not they're proceeding today. 2275 is in front of us, and we intend to get to it. 3086, we will get to it and talk about it. 2605, we will discuss it and see what we might have to do. These possible reconsiderations have to do with fiscal impact statements. Apparently, we're moving faster than the rest of the world, and sometimes these things come in after we've done things. On the victims' rights, HCR 87 through HCR 94, we have them listed for work session, and what we will really do is if anyone wants to provide some testimony, they could send me a note, and I could call in invited testimony to discuss them. Otherwise, we're probably not going to spend a lot of time on those today because we do not have formal amendments to move on. As to HB 2807, we are awaiting amendments from Representative Lewis, so we will not work on that today. On HB 2808, we will wait until tomorrow on that because we have Senate Bill 740A set in front of us. And a lot of what 2808 deals with is covered in 740A. We'd like to see what the Senate has done before we work on this issue ourselves. We're trying to avoid duplication. On 3395, we'll work it if we get to it. And I say that because of the time frame. 3374, we have the amendments in front of us, and we will try to get to that today and for at least work part of it. 2535, if there are folks who would like to offer some comments, we will be glad to open a work session and invite some testimony, but there are no formal amendments for us to consider at this time, and realistically, I think you should look to a real discussion and work session next week on 2535, although we're keeping it on the agenda. Senate Bill 700 is going to the House floor without recommendation. There's some discussion by some people that they would like to send that bill to us. If that bill comes to us, I'd want to hear Senate Bill 700 and then consider 2535 in that context. So we're keeping 2535 with the motor running, but the gas tank not completely full and no roadmap on hand. 2350... we have some amendments in front of us, and we may get to that today. 2352, we will not work on today. 2353, we will not work on today. 2903 is intended to be the Brust case fix, and it looks like we're ready to work on that today. And 3596 is in front of us today also. So we'll work as many of these as we can. I'll take us back to 2275 and open a work session on House Bill 2275. Counsel, could you explain why this is back in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, this is the mail theft bill, and as our committee has been moving fairly quickly, as the chairman said, we had a sort of a rough idea from Fiscal, who was doing really a very good job of getting information on this, and that information at the time was that it probably did not need to go to Ways and Means or have a fiscal impact of above $50,000. as some further data was gathered, it appeared that the impact would be above $50,000, and we have continued to receive information even as late as last night from Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. That is the reason this is back before the committee for possible reconsideration. And we do not have a final fiscal on this, but the committee should have been provided with sort of a rough draft of some figures.
Colleagues, we have a couple of options in front of us. One option is to rescind the referral to the floor and refer the bill to Ways and Means. Another option is to, if we have unanimous consent, to conceptually amend the bill to take out the emergency clause and delay the effective date to, say, January 1, 2001, so that there are no immediate operational impacts. I'm getting a little concerned. We've been trying to be careful not to send too many things to Ways and Means. They're going to have a pretty long agenda already, and we've sent, roughly speaking, perhaps a dozen bills there, which is more. At some point, they won't have time, I think, to get through all of them, and I don't want it to become the graveyard. At this point, I don't think it is a graveyard for our bills, but it may become one if we keep sending things to Ways and Means. I will also mention, in the past, some committees have gotten by having to bite the bullet on some bills by sending them to Ways and Means as a way of getting rid of things. That has not been the way we've handled bills. We've only sent things we're serious about to Ways and Means. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I guess I would be concerned with continuing to delay implementation dates, because even though there are many of us that won't be here next session, what we're doing is really limiting the ability of people next session to be making decisions about what the priorities are. And so I would not support doing a delay implementation.
Well, why don't we do this then? Representative Hansen.
By removing the emergency clause, we're not really delaying the implementation. We're not, in effect, we're not speeding the implementation up. So a subtle difference.
Well, that's a good point. The emergency clause brings us into effect probably in June. And that's a fast impact. Why don't we ask Ann Christian from the State Court Administrator's Office to come up? And you may be able to help us a bit with this. Maybe not. I see. We have a deputy district attorney here who might be able to help us, too. Maybe not.
And Mr. Right. Chair, Mr. Lemon, perhaps, could help.
How about Phil Lemon?
All these volunteers.
Sure. Well, what we're looking at, Mr. Taylor, do you want to come up too? All right, he was joking.
No, he wasn't.
I'm never sure who had something to do with the input at Ways and Means, LFO. Why don't I just ask the two of you where we are in terms of fiscal impact figures that you've been looking at, and whether or not some slight delay, such as a regular implementation date, would take care of that issue.
Mr. Chair, Phil Lemon from the Criminal Justice Commission. I don't think delaying the bill, I'm assuming by the regular implementation, that would be January 1. I don't think that would help you avoid sending this bill to Ways and Means. As counsel said, we were operating under very minimal information, and at 4:57 yesterday, I got some information from Multnomah County that I forwarded to counsel, and we haven't incorporated that in yet. But just in looking, I think you're still going to, moving it back to the regular effective date would still require referral.
All right. Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Unless we want to continue more discussions, I'm going to make the motion to, rescind our previous action of sending it to the floor, and then amend that or include in that a referral to Ways and Means. Yes, recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves that we rescind the previous action in sending this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that we send the bill to Ways and Means of the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? We should know the motion is made, or at least some of us will vote for it with regret, but that's the way it goes, and that's the process. All right. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried. House Bill 2275 is now pulled back from the referral to the floor and is sent to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. That concludes the work session on House Bill 2275. Let's move into work session on House Bill 3086. Counsel, where are we on this bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this bill is before the committee for roughly the same reasons, but we do not have any information really yet that I would feel comfortable presenting to the committee, saying that it does definitely need to go to Ways and Means. Well, I don't have any information back from fiscal.
Right. But I was just looking out in the audience because Ann Christensen and I spoke about this. Mr. Chair, just as a reminder, this is the one that would actually require an upfront guilty plea before an individual is allowed into the diversion. We had a similar situation 2 years ago when we were looking at the potential of the recriminalization on the marijuana issue, which was going to require, again, the person to be of their rights before they enter the plea, before they could go into a diversion program if they wanted to do that. And from what I remember in this year, if I remember correctly, we have something like close to 15, 20,000 people that are cited a year for DUII, and it would seem quite obvious that that upfront requirement would definitely put it over the $50,000 mark.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue. I had a discussion last night with Paul Siebert from LFO, and he indicated a desire to continue gathering information.
All right, what we'll do is set this over until tomorrow, so we'll see what happens. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3086. Next up is House Bill 2605. We'll go into work session on House Bill 2605. Council, what's the update on that?
Mr. Chairman, we are here for the same reasons on this, and I believe we received this morning a fiscal from LFO, and this does reflect my conversation with LFO last night, indicating that contrary to what we initially believed at the time this was before the committee most recently, this does have an impact of over $50,000 for both this next biennium and the biennium after that.
It looks like 90-something thousand dollars for the upcoming biennium.
Correct.
And that's 106,000 for the next biennium.
If we delayed the impact, the implementation to, this has got a standard implementation date right now, which is January 1, 2000.
Let me confirm that. I believe that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Did we add the Dash 7 amendments to this bill while we were acting on it?
No.
No, we did not.
Well, if we made this operative July 1, 2001, we would be able to, I mean, we're on the margin here, and so it's not going to be an overwhelming fiscal impact next biennium, but if we can avoid sending a few of these to Ways and Means by holding back implementation dates, since this is a whole new policy add-on, we're in work session. First of all, I need a motion to rescind the referral to the floor with a due pass.
So moved.
President Przanski, so moves. Is there objection to that motion? Seeing no objection, the referral to the floor with a due pass is rescinded. I would entertain a motion that we adopt the Dash 7 amendments, which were not previously adopted, which they may need to be blended in with the other amendments, but that's an LC function, which would make the operative date of this act July 1, 2001. Do I hear such a motion? President Sinceri moves that we adopt the Dash 7 amendments with any technical changes necessary to fit them in with the bill, to make the bill operative July 1, 2001. Discussion on that?
Mr. Chair, do we have any concept of how many bills we've done that to already that we have? I think anyone with major fiscal. Especially if we're going to pass a constitutional. Fiscal impact bills, and we're not, and the next legislative session is going to have how they respond to those issues.
That's a legitimate concern, Representative Bowman, and my perspective is if it was millions and millions of dollars, I would see us as driving the budgetary system next time. When it's $100,000 or $200,000, it's a judgment call as to whether you want to risk losing the policy change in the burdensome work of Ways and Means, and I'd like to go in there and with as limited a number of bills as possible and argue forcefully for those, and in that process, each additional bill that we have to argue over, there's some give and take. Again, if this was $1 million fiscal impact or even $500,000, I'd be somewhat concerned about driving it. But for instance, the Department of Corrections appropriation is somewhere, what, $742 million this biennium is proposed. And so in context, I worry less when we're talking about $100,000 and delaying it. And
well,
I have the court appropriation to consider. Ann Christian wanted to add something, but I'll hear from Representative Bowman and invite up Ann Christian.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, but I think if you add them all together is what we have to look at. Just what is the impact of all the things that we're delaying the implementation on, and just what's the fiscal cost of everything combined. And you're right, $100,000 here, $100,000 there is no big deal. But if you start adding up those little $100,000s here and $100,000s there, it could be significant.
Ann Christian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm the Director of Indigent Defense Services Division, and I'm never quite certain what Legislative Fiscal included in their fiscal impact statement. I provided one to Legislative Fiscal that does provide that at a minimum, we believe, and it's a difficult bill to do a fiscal on because we don't have anything. Just to refresh your memory, this is the mandatory true life sentence for an individual with a second conviction for one of five sex offenses, and we don't have any similar type of creature out there where we can look at the current experience. And so I just want to make it clear for the record that our fiscal, at least for indigent defense, indicates $63,000 or more per biennium. And the other thing I would note is that giving it a little additional time may allow us to get some better information. Department of Corrections estimated that there would be 36 individuals per year who would be impacted by this bill. I don't believe that they were able to take into account the appropriate treatment, opportunity for appropriate treatment that was part of the -6 amendments. And with that, for the record, thank you for inviting me up.
All right, thank you. Well, what's the sense of the committee? We have this.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think on all of these, I mean, I understand we have some very good policies, but if we're trying to keep government within the confines of what we have in the way of revenue, we need to be making those decisions, and maybe once we get the stuff down there, then we need to do some type of prioritization. My concern, I think, goes even a little bit further than what Representative Bowman has said. There's been clear indication that there may be another substantial hit to the general revenue, especially if an initiative should be passed that gives people basically a tax credit or a tax write-off of their federal taxes they pay to the state. And I guess I'm just not ready to load up the system that we basically tie the hands even further as to what may need to be discussed at that time, if that should in fact be an impact. It's not my preferred way of doing legislation, but I do like to work within the system. This is over the limits, and to me it seems like a lot of the smaller ones we'll be able to get through. As the chair knows, we've cut the district attorney's budget by $5 million to allow for counties to have that money for the tax and assessments. I see that's where the one that's going to get punched and squeezed during the next 2 years is the district attorney's office, because I've received correspondence since that conduct, or since that that has actually occurred, and the concern that I'm hearing is that they're going to be pushed because we're going to have more law enforcement officers and bringing more stuff to them, and the judges are also being, I guess it looks like we may not get any new judgeships. And so I'm real concerned about who's going to take the blunt. And the last thing I want to see is then have to make more and more decisions of what's going to be the priority to be prosecuted or not prosecuted. And just adding more to it, I think, may be a disservice for the communities.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Simmons.
I would prefer to send this bill onto the floor, quite frankly. I know there is some concern for fiscal issues, and those are well taken, actually. But especially if we were to adopt the -7s, I think it would be fine to send this bill on the floor, and I would certainly support that.
Okay. Well, since the maker of the motion is not with us, I'll recess the work session on House Bill 2605, and we will carry on. I've mentioned earlier that the HDRs will not be dealt with today, but I will pause and ask if there's anyone who especially came who wanted to testify on the Victims' Rights Amendments. I don't see anybody here on that. I would like to raise one question and invite Mr. Rice or Mr. Fidanky to address us if they wish, or any other representatives in the District Attorney's Office. So, for the record, I will take us into work session on HDR 87 through HDR 94. And I'm just raising this question because I read an article in the latest Oregon State Bar Bulletin, the Lawyer's Journal, raising the question about SB 936 and the fact that it limited the jury pool for criminal trials to persons who are not felons and who are registered voters, but did not do so for civil trials. I wasn't happy with that, but that's the way it was, the bill was. And, of course, the idea was the Victims' Rights Amendment only restricted the jury pool for criminal trials because the Victims' Rights Amendment dealt with crime. They had fitted into the relating clause or make it germane. The HDRs that we have in front of us, one in particular, deals with jury composition. The one about the right to a jury trial in criminal cases is pretty clear, but I'm talking about the question of jury composition being restricted to so that felons cannot be on the jury, someone convicted of a felony or having been adjudicated within the last 15 years, and the provision that you have to be a registered voter. The question which arises is whether or not this raises equal protection issues or other issues under the Constitution, the federal Constitution, if you have two types of jury pools. There's always the practical question as to why have two types of jury pools. We never had two types in Oregon until this happened. Of course, we always restricted juries as to membership until a few years ago, too. And it may be that folks will want to talk about this later, since I just sprang that question on them. But I think it's a question we need to discuss. One could make the argument, well, we're focusing on criminal juries because that's the only, and that would include grand juries, which we need to probably be precise about. I've seen that there's an argument raised that reference to juries, criminal juries, does not necessarily include grand juries. So we probably need to be clarifying that. But also the argument that only in criminal cases is somebody's liberty at stake, so that there's a rational basis for the government to make a distinction between the composition of those juries and others. You could particularly make the argument that someone convicted of a felony is likely to have a certain amount of bias in handling a criminal trial and serving on a jury as to his feelings about the criminal justice system, so that person might be automatically disqualified from service. It's a little tougher argument as to why you would say that criminal jury jurors have to be registered voters, but they don't have to be on civil juries. And again, the only argument might be that you want a higher level of civic involvement for somebody who gets to determine whether or not somebody else's liberty will be circumscribed, as opposed to their property, which is all that's really at risk technically in civil cases. Does anybody want to discuss that, or would you just like to think about that for when we're doing the heavier work sessions on these specific bills? Mr. Rice?
Thank you, Chairman Mannix. Members of the committee, Jim Rice, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I got back to my office at about 5 last night, and I saw the Oregon State Bar Bulletin in my box. I have not read this article. What I could say is this. The lawyer who wrote the article is a criminal defense lawyer and a patent lawyer, and she has spent a tremendous amount of time working on this particular research project that she has taken on, and I could ask her to come in from Newport and address the issue. She probably knows them far better than I do. I'm unprepared at this time to really get into the technical questions you're asking. I will point out one thing. There may be a misapprehension about something. If someone in their earlier years commits a felony, wait 7 or 8 years, and when they become employed and they're no longer sort of the young, reckless person on the street but are working and have a car and live in a neighborhood, I found they actually aren't the sort of squishy juror pro-defense type at all, and many times, if they've rehabilitated themselves, you'll find that they're more pro-government than one would even suspect. There's a lot of change that takes place in people who've been through the criminal justice system. So I personally don't think that they're necessarily pro or against, and that's just my own personal experience. But I think this is a complex issue, and if we're going to address the constitutionality of it, if you could indicate when you'd like to hear from Ms. Jade, I would attempt to bring her in here so the committee could decide the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Well, we'll discuss this further, and I just wanted to sort of flag that issue. It's an interesting point.
It is. Thank you.
Does anyone else want to volunteer on that one? I don't see any other volunteers, but at least we've got the issue on the table. This will close the work session on the combined HJRs, or combined work session, I should say. We'll go back into the recessed work session on House Bill 2605. Representative Sinceri, we had pending your motion to adopt the Dash 7 amendments with any technical blend that would be necessary so as to delay the implementation date of the bill to July 1, 2001. After you stepped out of the room, there's been some indication of opposition to this motion. So the main concern being the fiscal impact of this kind of legislation over time. And I don't know if you want to comment on that or if you simply want us to move on to a vote.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't mind moving on to a vote. I think that I just say let's just move on to the vote.
All right. We have in front of us a motion to modify House Bill 2605 to adopt the Dash 7 amendments to delay the operative date of the legislation to July 1, 2001. I'd ask Rachel Short, our clerk, to call the roll.
No.
Representative Gianella? Yes. Representative Hanson? No. Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Sabonsky?
No.
Chair
Manning?
Aye. The motion carries. The bill has been amended. Representative Sinceri, do you move to send the bill to the floor with the due pass as amended?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Colleagues, you have the motion in front of you. Is there objection to that motion?
Object.
If you will please call the roll on the motion to send the bill to the floor with due pass.
Representative Bowman?
No.
Representative Gianella?
Aye.
Representative Hanson?
No.
Representative Lemon?
Aye.
Representative Perry?
Aye.
Representative Kazansky?
No.
Aye. The motion carries, and House Bill 2605 is sent to the floor with a due pass. Who do we have as a carrier on this?
Representative Sinceri.
Yeah. All right.
And
Sinceri will be carried.
Mr. Chairman, there was a notice of possible minority report previously. Is that notice renewed?
I'm going to just do it right now. Let's wait until I went up to you.
I see.
Notice of possible minority report on 2605.
All right. We have a notice of possible minority report. This concludes the work session on House Bill 2605. We will now move to House Bill 3395 and go into work session on 3395. Council, where are we with that bill?
Mr. Chairman, this is a bill relating to hearsay and other evidentiary rules, and the committee has heard it a couple of times in the past couple of weeks. The Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments are before the committee. If the committee wanted to adopt either one of the amendments, it would not need to adopt the other set of amendments because they are alternatives to each other, and I believe that there is someone here who can go into a bit more detail about the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments.
Should we invite us?
I believe Mr. Dingell is here. Was there somebody else here as well on that?
Mr. Dingell, would you like to come forward, please?
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Dingell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Actually, I just saw the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments for the first time this morning. I think as I understand it, the issue is whether or not it is the amendments will actually amend the definition of hearsay as opposed to make it an exception. And that's the difference I see looking at the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. really, the association's position is it really doesn't matter how we do that as long as the policy that is embodied in these amendments is carried forward, and that is to allow these statements that are made by victims within the parameters that have been discussed, which I understand are 24 hours and to a law enforcement officer, et cetera, to be used as substantive evidence. Because this is, I think, and actually, I don't know if the committee has the letter to Chairman Mannix from Mr. Baloof.
Yes,
I think he very clearly sets out what the issue is, which is the classic situation of domestic violence where the person calls it in, reports it, and then by the time it appears at trial, the person has changed their story, and if that's all you have, then obviously the statements made to the officer that night, unless they are an excited utterance, are not substantive evidence.
And Mr. Dingell, as I see this, it looks like the dash twos are a little more limited in range because they leave out. The dash ones include an act of abuse as defined in 107.705 or 419B005, and the dash twos do not.
Right, and that was the other thing I wanted to address. Clearly, our priority is the domestic violence, and I understand from talking with Mr. Penn last night at our meeting that there was some concern on the part of the committee of extending this to sexual abuse cases.
So the more limited version is the dash two, and this would also limit basically the legislation to domestic violence situations.
Correct.
All right.
And as I understand it, it makes it, at least as I read the dash twos, it takes it out of, and I understand this is maybe a distinction without a difference for some members, but what it does is it does not change the difference of hearsay. It makes it an exception under 18, which is the one that was reserved for additional exceptions later when it was drafted in 1981.
Mr. Chair?
President Bomer.
I move the dash two amendments into House Bill 3395.
All right. President Bowman moves adoption of the dash two amendments.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if I could just get a clarification.
Certainly.
Could I just hear you made a passing comment about sexual offenses?
Chairman Mannix, Representative Sincere, yes. As Chairman Mannix pointed out, one of, and I believe it's the dash, yes, the dash one amendments would, in essence, create the same exception for complaints involving sexual abuse by a child. In other words, those statements could be considered as substantive evidence in the same situation. In other words, the child were to report the abuse to a law enforcement person within a prescribed period of time, get on the stand, the child says it never happened, or they forget, or whatever. Those earlier statements could be used as substantive evidence.
The dash ones do not, or excuse me, the dash twos don't allow that.
No, the dash twos limit it strictly to the domestic violence situation.
And if I understand it too, it might be best to proceed cautiously in that one area and see how things go. We can always, in future sessions, take a look at go beyond that.
And I understand that that was actually part of the theory behind putting it in the dash. In the form that it is in the dash two amendments, because there was apparently concern on the part of some people about actually amending the definition of hearsay.
Very well. We have a motion in front of us to adopt the dash two amendments, the motion by Representative Bowman. Is there further discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Seeing an objection, the dash two amendments are adopted. Representative Bowman?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3395 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there further discussion? Representative Gianella.
So I just want to make sure, Mr. Chairman, that the hearsay evidence is only admissible when there's proof that they've been hurt or battered. Is that true?
Mr. Dingell, maybe I'll have this question. You have to be testifying at the hearing. It has to be inconsistent with an earlier statement. You have to be given an opportunity to explain or deny the statement. Mr. Dingell, is there something else about?
No, that's it, Chairman Mannix and Representative Gianella. That's correct. This is not a situation where the declarant or the person making the statement would be unavailable at trial. They would have to actually appear. The situation would be the police respond. They make a complaint that they've been assaulted. The district attorney proceeds. They're at trial either in front of a judge or a jury, and then the complaining victim would say nothing happened. both sides would have an ample opportunity to cross-examine the person about their earlier statements, why their statements might have been changed, etc.
So the person has to be available to be cross-examined.
Okay.
Yes, I think the representative was thinking about the corroborative evidence that we discussed previously about the injuries and stuff.
In any of these cases, it's going to be a matter for the trier of fact to determine whether or not something occurred, and they're going to have to look at all the evidence. And if there's a lack of corroborative evidence, that has to be considered by the trier of fact.
I would determine, Max, if I could, Representative Gianelli, you're going to still have all the same requirements that are in place for any offense. If it's a misdemeanor, the officer has to have probable cause, and the district attorney is going to have more than probable cause. They're going to have to believe that they have sufficient facts to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And if it involves a felony, then that matter is going to have to go through the screening process for the grand jury, if it's a felony domestic assault. But there is no specific separate section that requires some quantum or description of evidence before this provision would apply, other than the one that exists currently in law.
Yes. I feel, I can only say, much more comfortable with what we have before us now than what we had in embarking before. I think, you know, this is an area that Mr. Dingell and I and Mr. Horton have tried many more cases than we care to try. And it does, I guess, give some safeguards that the individuals now need is going to have to actually be there. So there's going to give their ability for the rightful to confront the witness and stuff. And more than likely, you're not going to get a conviction just on this alone. You're going to have that corroborating evidence of somebody actually seeing injury at least, or maybe someone else that was there that independently observed.
And Chair Mannix, Representative Brzezinski, this is the classic situation. This is why we have juries. The witness will sit there and the witness will testify, and the jury will decide whether they were telling the truth when they contacted the police or whether they were telling the truth when they say that nothing happened. That's why we have juries.
Yeah. And, Mr. Chair, I think the other thing is that currently this type of evidence would be allowed, and if the person testified and is in contradiction and they were basically for impeachment, the only difference now is that it can come in as substantive evidence besides for the purpose of impeaching a witness for maybe changing their story.
And I guess if that makes, I think that is an important distinction or important point to make, juries would hear this evidence now and do hear this evidence now when the witness appears.
Mr. Horton.
Just in sort of furtherance of what Representative Gianella had inquired about, I think the point there was that the hearsay evidence in and of itself, if that was all the evidence that a prosecutor had, really wouldn't be enough to convict a person. There would normally, for assault, for need to be actually some evidence of the injury.
Well, there'd have to be some evidence supporting physical injury, and if all you have from the person is that this person struck me, and that were the statements you had, you'd still have to have somebody who observed an injury.
Right.
Some proof of that element. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried. House Bill 3395 is sent to the floor. With the
Mr. Chair, that was just a dash to adoption.
Oh, I thought we already adopted those. I apologize.
They were.
Yes.
Did we?
Yes.
I'm fine.
Okay. Never mind.
So that was the adoption, and for the record, I'll state that. We have just adopted, passed the motion to send House Bill 3395 as amended with the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Bowman has volunteered to be the carrier. She'll be assigned as carrier of the bill. This closes the work session. That concludes 3395. I'm going to skip over 3374 simply because there's a lot to that, and I'm concerned about juggling a number of things here. We'll keep it humming here for a bit. And it looks like, again, 2535 is not ready. Someone's driving down from Portland to talk to us about 2350, so I'll skip over that. I've already mentioned 2352 and 2353 are not ready. Let's move to 2903. And go into work session on 2903. And council, give us an update.
Mr. Chairman, the committee has before two amendments, -1 and -2. They are both amendments that would replace the original bill. And what the first one is the state v. Brust fix that has been before the committee several times in other vehicles. And it would fit within the relating clause in this bill. And then the -2 amendments are also here at the request of the Attorney General's office and simply remove the word conventional from the definition of handgun. There were some concerns that that word might have been a bit vague. I know that there is a representative from the Attorney General's office here to discuss these if the committee would like to hear anything about these two amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Prasanna.
Could we just get an update as to reflection on the fix from the court on the dash ones?
Yes, and why don't we ask the representative from the Department of Justice to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Amesbury. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Justice and the Attorney General.
Hey, could you just go over what the fixes are that we're going to be making with these two amendments, just for the record?
All right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Prasanna, I apologize that I have just received the -1 and the -2 amendments this morning. From my reading, the -2 fix is included within the -1. So I will address the overall bill as it would be amended by the 2903-1s. Basically, it contains four provisions. The first would make a general prohibition against carrying a concealed handgun within a vehicle applicable to passengers as well as the driver of the vehicle. The current statutory language suggests that it only applies to the driver of the vehicle. The second fix would respond to the Court of Appeals decision in Brust, which held that the state must prove that an individual did not have a permit in order to convict them of carrying a concealed handgun without a permit. It made that an element of the crime. And there are some problems with that because there is no centralized database for maintaining information about who has been issued a permit and who has not. It's issued at the county level, and each county maintains its own records on how that's done.
Just for the record, again, I guess what that would basically do is just require the individual who's claiming that they had the permit that they would have to bring the proof as kind of a defense, charge.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prasanna, that's correct. It would take the issuance of a handgun permit out of the list of elements of the crime and create an affirmative defense that an individual could come in and show that he had a valid handgun permit at the time, and in that case the statute would not apply to him. The third fix...
right now the problem is that the prosecution has to prove that there was no such permit issued.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Under the Brust decision, which is a Court of Appeals decision, the way the statute reads is that a person carried, I'll paraphrase because I'm not quoting
that's
it,
right.
A person carries a handgun concealed upon his person without having been issued a permit to carry the handgun. The Court of Appeals determined that permit to carry is an element of the offense, and the state must prove that he has not been issued a handgun permit, in essence, in any county in the state in the past 4 years. Now, there's no centralized database. There are some databases which record this information, but nothing which would satisfy evidentiary requirements to prove that he had not been issued a permit.
So let's clarify this. So we would have really two choices, one desirable, one undesirable, at least from my impact, from my perspective. The undesirable choice is to create a centralized registry of concealed handgun permits, which the prosecutors could use then to prove their case. The other is to simply say, look, if you got a permit somewhere, come in and show it to us as an affirmative defense.
Those are essentially, I mean, there are other choices, but those are the two choices that really are presented here. That's correct. There could be some kind of a centralized database or require the individual claiming to have a permit to prove that in court. The current situation would require, as my understanding, a prosecutor to bring a representative from each county of the state to a prosecution to testify that they have reviewed their own records and that person has not been issued a permit to carry.
Because it's a county-based system of the sheriff's issuing the permits.
That's correct, Mr.
President. Prasanna.
It's 36 counties. I don't know if they'd actually have to have a live witness. They probably could do something through a business record or a public record. that's kept by the county, but the bottom line is, whoever's prosecuting that case is going to have to make at least 36 inquiries.
Mr. Chair, to clarify one thing, as somebody who prosecuted a number of these cases over the past 2 or 3 years, in almost every instance of which I'm aware, the trial courts have assumed that the language currently in the statute is an affirmative defense. I believe there was one case that then went to the appellate level where the appellate court said, no, that's not the case, and it came as a surprise to a lot of people. What this language would do is basically to conform the language of the statute to what, in my experience, has been existing practice for the past few years.
So this fulfills the expectations that were out there rather than creating something new.
That's
practically speaking.
That's practically speaking. That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Simmons.
What is the effect of these amendments on the original bill, page 3, line 4, where it reduces the retention of records from 5 years to 2 years?
This is a gut and stuff.
Gut and stuff.
So we don't get to slip anything through here.
And so the go over with me then the practical change from current law that this would represent.
In terms of practical change, there is no practical change from what people thought the law was until the Brust decision came down. Technical change is that under the Brust decision, what was thought to be an affirmative defense so that you didn't have to start out by proving that there was no permit in 36 counties, but instead ask the person to show that they had a permit, that was the practice. The Brust decision says, no, we don't read the statute that way. You're going to have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no permit issued in 36 counties. And this bill will say, no, we're going to go and say you need to, you can make the charge that the person didn't have a permit, and then if they say they did, they need to just bring in the evidence that they had the permit. And then that's an affirmative defense, and if they establish that they had the permit, they win.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, the burden of proof is on the permit carrier rather than to prove his innocence rather than on the government to prove your guilt.
All elements of the crime have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt by the prosecution, which would include that you had a handgun, that it was concealed on the person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they would have to then allege that there was no permit issued, and the defendant would have to turn around and say, yes, there was, and you may want to explain that if you'd like.
Mr. Chairman, I believe you've probably adequately capsulized it. It would become an affirmative defense, and the defendant, Representative Simmons, would have the opportunity to come in and present the permit or present other evidence and provide a preponderance of the evidence that he, in fact, had a permit issued to him. But under the current statute in the Brust decision, someone could in essence, they wouldn't even have to say anything. The state would have an obligation to prove affirmatively, beyond a reasonable doubt, that this person had never been issued a permit in any county in the state in the past 4 years. It just creates a large burden for the state to bring this evidence from each county for every prosecution. And the Brust decision, as committee counsel has pointed out, was a surprise to most of the individuals who were involved with this statute, because it was always assumed that that was an affirmative defense, that if you had a permit to carry and you were carrying concealed, then you had to show your card or bring in court evidence to show that you had in fact been issued a permit. You didn't just need to sit there silently.
Now, we should also mention that there is specifically a section here in the Dash 1 amendments which says that if someone has that card on them, it's a valid card, the officer may not arrest them and may not charge them for carrying without the permit. That's an important point to make. President Simmons.
If I may follow up on that. So if I'm out pistol shooting in my pickup and then in the course of getting back out of the gravel pit where I go and I throw this my handgun in the seat and some other stuff gets thrown on top of, say, my coat or something, and I go home and park the pickup, and next thing I know, my wife jumps in the pickup and runs to the ground and gets stopped. She has a handgun readily accessible to her,
and unbeknownst to her, and she gets stopped, she's guilty of violating the intent of this. She has no permit, and she has a firearm readily accessible to her in a vehicle. You want to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simmons, I'm almost afraid to touch the hypothetical, but I think under the current law, she could still be convicted. The only difference would be that, well, I'm assuming she had the knowledge. There's a knowledge intent.
The scenario was that she had no knowledge.
So if she has no knowledge, then I don't think that she can be convicted. I think there's an implied criminal knowledge intent. But assuming she, of course, if she didn't know about it, it was hidden under the seat, then that's not an issue that's raised in this bill. The only change to this is if she could be convicted under the current language, she would still be able to be convicted under the bill as it changes. It doesn't create criminal liability. All it does is fulfill the expectations, I think, of all the prosecutors who have used this bill in the past, that if someone claims to have a permit, they have to show they have it, rather than the state being required to make this proof that the permit has never been issued. So I don't know that it really addresses the situation that you've hypothesized.
In order to be convicted of carrying a concealed firearm, the state has to prove that you knew you had the firearm. And so if you knew it was under the seat, I suppose, that's the current law. This doesn't change that. Representative Krasinski, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing on line 8. Representative Simmons, it says a person knowingly, and that's always been the law. The real difference here is that the state still has to come in and still prove beyond reasonable doubt every element except for that the person did not have a permit to carry a concealed weapon. If they are able to show all other elements, then the defendant would be given the opportunity on what's known as an affirmative defense to say, yes, but I've got this permit.
As a practical matter, it would never get to that point in trial, because in the extremely rare case that the charge was filed by the prosecutor and then the person came forward and said, oh, yeah, look, I do have this. I mean, I've never seen that happen, but if it did, there is no prosecutor in the state that would not drop the case like a hot potato.
Representative Hansen.
If I could make an analogy, this seems to me a little bit like if someone was stopped and couldn't produce a driver's license and they were charged with driving without a license, to make that conviction stick, that the state would have to prove that in the other 50 states they hadn't been given they had never been issued a driver's license. That I think it's
there may be something different on driver's licenses in the sense that you have to carry the permit on your person. In this case, carrying a permit is sort of like your force shield that prevents the officer from arresting you or charging you if you've got this concealed handgun permit. I'm not a motor vehicle laws expert, so I don't know. I assume there's a charge right now of driving without having your license on you.
30%, right.
Whereas this law talks about carrying a concealed handgun and then without having, well, I guess we're now saying that it's an affirmative defense to have the permit, but that if you have the permit in your hand or if you're carrying it on your person, they can't arrest you or charge you anyway. Am I correct about that?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Now I would like to clarify the Department of Justice has taken a position on all of the sections of the bill except for Section 5. That's new language that that involves the peace officer arrest or the restriction on a peace officer arresting someone who has a person permit on his person. Personally, I don't believe it's a problem, but it has not been staffed with the Attorney General, so I cannot represent to the committee that the Attorney General is on board with that section.
Well, I'll hear from Representative Krasinski and then Mr. Dingell, and I'm going to ask you to come up. Representative Krasinski.
Mr. Chair, this is actually language that we used, and I know Rob Harder's here. I think it was the federal permits for people having machine guns, where people that are basically going or some type of exhibitor going from show to show. We added this similar language, if not the exact same language, in a bill, gosh, 2 years or 4 years ago. That basically gave a protection so long as the dealers had that license in their possession, they would not go through the rigmarole of going through the system because they just had it with them. But if they didn't have it, they could in fact be cited, and then as we've already discussed, they could come in and just say, I'm sorry, I didn't have it with me, I misplaced it, but here it is. And it basically would make the case go away before it went any further. So this, I assume, mirrors exactly what we've had before, just applying it now to a state license.
That's one of the best, too, so totally different.
Yeah,
they are. One is a conventional handgun, and the other is something else.
Representative Ianella has a question.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pozanski may have, Representative Pozanski may have answered my question, but I was distracted, and so if I'm repeating it, I'm sorry. If you had a handgun and the permit was in the wrong purse, but the handgun was in your purse, but the permit was in the other purse. Now, can't they just check the records? Can't you just tell them, I have it? Can you just look on the records, or do you have to have that number? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gianella, the bill as drafted would prevent a peace officer from arresting a person based on a concealed handgun charge if they had the permit on their person immediately.
Let me help everybody. I'm going to interrupt here and ask everybody to look at page 4 of the Dash 1 amendments and also look at page 3. We are putting the concealed handgun permit person in the same status as sheriffs, constables, marshals, corrections officers. If you've got a concealed handgun license, you're the same as a peace officer. That's important. However, peace officers usually carry some form of identification, and even if it was a peace officer got stopped and they didn't have any ID and they're carrying a concealed handgun, the other officer will arrest them or can arrest them. So the concealed handgun permit is as good as an officer's badge. You show it to the guy who stopped you, and he can't arrest you or charge you. He can probably check LEDs because he's got your ID number on that to make sure it's a good badge. And I think that sort of cuts to the chase here, because we're not saying it's an affirmative defense in the sense that we say on lines 20 and 21 of page 4 of the Dash 1 amendments, we're adding a person with a concealed handgun permit to the list of people who are allowed to carry concealed handguns. And it's the same, again, if you look at all the categories there, it's the same as all those other people. No better, no worse. And we're adding the protection. Be smart, carry your permit on you, and if you don't, and they can't check you out at the time for some reason. Now, if they check, the common sense thing is they're going to check, they're going to run leads, they're going to call the sheriff of the county where you say you got your permit, and I'd say, check with Sheriff Ramirez, Marion County, I must have left it at home or something. And if they find out you've got it, they're probably going to say, go on your way. But if you don't, it hasn't been issued, then they'll maybe confiscate the fire, maybe arrest you and charge you. That's, I'm trying to explain that in the real-world context so that we understand that. But legally, once the charges are proceeding, right now it's presented as though the prosecution has to prove the negative, that nowhere in the world of Oregon was there ever such a permit issued to you. And this says, wait a minute, once this prosecution is going forward, they get to allege that you didn't have a permit, and if you did have one, come forward and demonstrate that. Which I think affirmative defenses are presented by a preponderance of the evidence.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So it's not even, you don't have the burden beyond a reasonable doubt. You just say, here it is. Does that summarize it? Doesn't bother me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. Is the Dash 1 and 2 combined? Did I hear you say we had to adopt 1 and 2?
Well, that's a good question. Mr. Horton's going to inquire about that.
I do want to inquire about that thing, Mr. Chairman, because it looks like in Section 2 of the Dash 1s, or S-166-210, generally does the same thing as the Dash 2s, but not identical. It looks like Section 4 of that statute is what is modified in both. However, the Dash 2s only remove the word conventional, and then looking more carefully, it looks like lines 16 to 17 on page 3 of the Dash 1s remove a bit more language. Which one do you prefer?
Mr. Chairman, the Dash 1s represent the position of the department. The difference between the two, both of them remove the qualifier conventional for handguns. So if you're carrying an unconventional handgun, you still fall within the statute. The Dash 1 amendment also deletes the reference to essentially machine pistols. Under the existing statute, a machine pistol is not covered by the definition. You could theoretically, you might violate another law, but you wouldn't violate this law by carrying a concealed machine pistol.
Machine pistol would be a machine gun by
federal
definition.
Well, a small one, that's correct. But it wouldn't fall under this. So we didn't see that there should be any defense that, oh, you can't get me for carrying a concealed handgun because it was capable of firing more than one shot with each press of the trigger. Just like with the word conventional, we couldn't see a reason to narrow it, that it should apply in these circumstances.
Go with the dash one, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, before we get any further on that, I think we have another bill that would clean all this up. I greatly resent having to get permission from the government to do anything I have a constitutional right to do. This tweaks around with the concealed carry stuff. We have no business having concealed, having to get a permit to carry your gun. We have another bill that would clean all this up, and we could just set this aside. It's the Vermont-style carry bill, and I would suggest we just go with that. I'm not ready to move this today.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment sent to House Bill 2903.
All right, we have a motion in front of us, and we also have a position in front of us from Representative Simmons. Thank you. Representative Gianelli.
Is it too late for me to get an opinion from a couple of people in
the
audience?
No, in fact, I intend to ask them up next. Thank you for assisting us. I see Mr. Skerritt and Mr. Harder. I think Representative Gianella would like to hear from you about the Dash 1 amendments. If you please introduce yourselves for the record.
For the record, I'm Rod Harder, National Rifle Association representative for Oregon. My comfort level has gone up considerably with the addition of the language on the last page. The Dash 2 amendment, if we're just speaking to the Dash 1 amendment, I don't like the Dash 2 amendments at all.
I think you can forget about that.
On the Dash 1 amendments, it's already illegal for you to carry concealed without your permit in your possession. That's already in the law. So your case where if you left your permit in your purse, that's prima facie evidence. If you're stopped with a handgun, you don't have a license. You're in violation at that point in time. So this really has little bearing on that part of it. The other question that I had with regards to this and was not addressed currently, the law says that you may carry a handgun concealed if you are going to or from hunting or to and from shooting. And I would want to be on the record as having it stated if this will or will not have any effect on that particular portion of the law.
That's a good question. Mr. Harder, at page 4, the existing law is still left in place, lines 22 through 30. It does not apply to or affect, unless you're otherwise prohibited, like a felon. So all the current language about being a member of a club, practicing shooting at targets, licensed hunters or fishermen while engaged in hunting or fishing, or while going to or returning from a hunting or fishing expedition.
So then we would not be, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, we would not then have people being cited and then have to use an affirmative defense to prove that they, in fact, were going hunting or were going to do whatever. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Current law is as it stands.
For the record, Kevin Starrett, Gun Owners of America and Oregon Firearms Federation. Come as no surprise that I share Representative Simmons' feelings about the Vermont bill. However, I guess Mr. Harder addressed most of my concerns. I do believe that, as he said, current law says if you don't have the permit in your possession, you don't have a permit. So this may be a solution in search of a problem. However, if this creates a solution to the problem, I have left my home without my wallet and carrying a firearm. If I were arrested and had my gun confiscated and I was charged being in possession of a gun, if this creates an affirmative defense to that because I can come back with the permit, that would be certainly a step forward, but I don't know that it does that necessarily.
Actually, it does.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
President Pazansky. Mr. It's language we've all talked about on the last page of the amendment, page 6, the new bold print, section 5. That basically sets up that if you find yourself in that position, sometimes the officers will say, go get your permit, come back to the police department, show it to me, and that's where the case ends. Or if it goes beyond that, it's going to come to the district attorney or the city attorney's office, and you would be able to have contact with those people, and they would say, you know, release the gun, and you're on your way.
And, I can pick up on that. Actually, under Section 5 at the end here, your permit is your shield. You can't take my firearm, you can't arrest me, you can't charge me. But if you don't have your permit, then turn to page 4 at the bottom and page 5 at the top, and it says that if you're licensed, and again, that's a reference to lines 20 and 21, the exception listed in the subsection 1H constitutes an affirmative defense to the charge of carrying without a permit. So you will be able to come in with your license and say, drop the charges.
Well, that clearly would be an improvement. The only question I have, and I don't know, I mean, if this would be considered rhetorical or not, but as far as a centralized database, I know when you apply for a pistol permit in this state, your name goes into LEDS. You don't even have to get it. And unless I misunderstand how LEDS works, it certainly seems to me that's a centralized database. And I know people all over the state who've been stopped on traffic violations, given the officer a driver's license, and they immediately wanted to know if they had a gun.
Well, apparently the centralized database is not, if it's complete, that's one thing. Even if it's complete, though, that's not a sufficient basis to prove the charge, because that's simply a database. They would have to go to the source of the information, because that's secondary records. And we've not put in the statute yet, thank goodness, that the database itself is proof of what is in it, because we know that those databases are not always accurate. So we're not relying on a database here, and I think it's a good idea that we're not.
I would agree with that.
And I don't think we want to tie ourselves to a database in regard to these issues either.
Nor do I.
I guess the question would be then, do you have a comfort level? Representative Gianella wanted to know about your comfort level with proceeding with the -1 amendments, which have been moved.
If it is as you're described, and I am going to assume it is, an affirmative defense, if I leave my license at home, yes, I would think that would be definitely a positive step.
All right. Mr. Rice wanted to come up. So Mr. Harvey,
for the record, for the -1s only, we would be in support of that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Minix, James Rice, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Would it be helpful, I mean, in one of these cases, if you're cited, you come into court, you have your first appearance, if the person accused presented at that first hearing a valid concealed handgun permit, that the statute would say the case shall be dismissed at that time? I don't know if that corrects any problem, but...
I appreciate it, but I think it might complicate things at this stage.
I would want to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. My intention is to allow us to proceed to a vote on the -1 amendments, and we have the bill all nice and ready, but to defer final action on the bill, some folks are concerned about looking at this in the context of 2535 and Senate Bill 700, and I'm willing to do that, but I do think that we need to know whether or not we want to, if we adopt the -1, I have a pretty good idea what the committee wants to do, and then we could sit on it. For a few days. If there's no, well, I'll ask, is there any objection to the adoption of the -1 amendments? Seeing no objection and five members being present, the -1 amendments are adopted. I will note for the record, I know Representative Simmons indicated he objected before, but I don't know if that was still standing based on what else we heard. So, but we have at least five members present, no objection. The -1 amendments are adopted into House Bill 2903. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2903 and move us into another bill. Now, 3596, that was still up for today.
It is, Mr. Chairman, and I can go over very briefly what the bill does if you'd like.
So 2903 is pending final action.
Mr.
David, you're up in the chair.
Pardon?
Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Go ahead, counsel.
Mr. Chairman, 3596 has a relating clause of relating to sex offenses, and the -3 amendments are before the committee. They would replace the original content of the bill, and the -3 amendments are a concept...
3596?
Excuse me, 3596. My apologies. The -3 amendments are a concept which has already been before the committee, and what it does is it raises public indecency to a Class C felony if the person has a prior conviction for public indecency already or for another sex crime. Normally, public indecency is a Class A misdemeanor. This would also require that the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission classify that crime as a felony, when it is a felony, rather, as a crime category 6 on the sentencing guidelines grid of the commission. All right. We're in work session on House Bill 3596. What about the earlier dash 1 and dash 2 were water under the bridge?
Yes.
Okay, different bill.
Yes.
Well, what's our comfort level with this?
There's only four of us in the room, which is why I asked that question.
Mr. Chair, I guess, we've talked about doing this, and I think Jeff Collins gave us some data, if I remember correctly, out of Arizona that kind of demonstrated that this is an area that maybe we do want to have a little bit more focus and concern in addressing this as a early alert or issue as to people that seem to be engaged in other sexual crimes. The only thing, I guess, is do we have a fiscal? Cause, I mean, I know that we're talking about kicking it in, and my understanding is that there would be some impact.
Mr. Chairman, not yet. I know the fiscal is working on it, but the early indication is that there would be an impact of above $50,000. Mr. Lemon, that was my understanding. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
But we'd have to send this to Ways and Means. Mr. Lemon, come on up.
Mr. Chair, members, Phil Lemon from the Commission. We have not run the actual numbers on this. There are several hundred arrests every year for public indecency. We have not gone back and looked at those to see if they have a prior conviction either for public indecency or a sex offense. But given that number and considering you only have to have 15 new felony convictions per year to hit the threshold, my guess is that it would need to go downstairs.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead and move the dash threes into the bill.
All right, the dash three, Representative Brzezinski moves adoption of the dash three amendments. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, the dash three amendments are adopted. Representative Brzezinski, do you want to move to send this to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation?
As amended, yes.
As amended. Colleagues, just the dash threes. Representative Brzezinski moves that we refer House Bill 3596 with the dash three amendments to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried. The bill is sent to Ways and Means. It due pass. Looks like I'm going to have a long meeting with Representative Westland at some point.
You better send donuts.
We've got some. That's right. This closes the work session on House Bill 3596. I'd like to take us back. Now, perhaps we could start doing some work on 3374. There's a whole bunch of amendments to that bill. Maybe we can get some of that done. So we'll go into work session on House Bill 3374. Council.
Mr. Chairman, we will start off with the... Well, first, I will remind the committee that the dash 3 and the dash 4 amendments were adopted, as were the dash 6 with a small conceptual amendment. What we have before the committee today is the dash 8 through the dash 15 amendments. And the dash 8 amendments, I believe, were requested by Representative Simmons, who's out of the room, and it reduces what is currently a Class A misdemeanor for using bait to attract or take black bears or use one or more dogs to hunt or pursue black bears or cougars down from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C misdemeanor. And it also affects the suspension time for hunting licenses. I know that the dash 9 amendments are before the committee, and I would defer on the dash 9s to Representative Prozanski.
We'll wait for his, when he's in here, we'll talk about his amendments. There's plenty of others to talk about, too. Thank you. Excuse me, Representative Brzezinski. Yep.
Mr. Chair, the dash 9s basically cover an area that you and I had spoken about, and it was brought to my attention after we talked at our last hearing. This is where we would be holding someone accountable for interfering with a peace officer, and the intent of all this previous legislation, including resisting arrest, that if someone was passively resisting, they would not be, let's say, subject to a charge of either resisting arrest, and it's always been intended that they would not be subject to a charge for interfering with a peace officer. And this basically clarifies that if someone is passively resisting, such as in a protest situation, they would not be subject to this law, specifically as if an officer asked them or ordered them to stand up to be arrested. That could be interpreted as refusal to obey a lawful order of an officer, and since this was supposed to protect the safeguards of the individuals that are peacefully without any violence, protesting that they would not be held accountable so long as it was only passive resistance. And also had the other component to it that's already been discussed regarding would not constitute a crime if they were resisting arrest of themselves or another, since they would in fact be charged with that as a separate crime.
Very well. I'm very sympathetic to that, and I appreciate the fact that Representative Brzezinski worked with, I think Kathy Osborne was the one who brought up this point, and we certainly do want to make sure that we cover that situation. Representative Brzezinski, do you move the Dash 9 amendments?
I do.
Representative Hansen.
Well, I'm be glad to support them, but I kind of thought the purpose of passive resistance was to get arrested. No, that this was the way you made your statement. I guess if there are some people that don't quite make that much of a statement, this is
a partial statement.
Yeah.
Okay.
Colleagues, we have the Dash 9 amendments in front of us. Representative Brzezinski has moved adoption of the Dash 9 amendment. Any further discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash 9 amendments are adopted. Council, why don't you start reading through some of these others?
Okay, certainly. The committee has before the Dash 10 and the Dash 11 amendments, which the committee could choose one of the two, but would not need to choose both. A few days ago, the committee had some amendments on this bill before it that would allow arrest for a Class B or a Class C misdemeanor not committed in the officer's presence. I think the committee recalls discussing that. And there is an issue regarding what is on lines 19 and 20 of both the Dash 10 and Dash 11 amendments regarding any other offense except for a traffic infraction and violation that is committed in the officer's presence. I had a discussion with legislative counsel about this, and I found out a very interesting answer. The current law, if you look at it, says that any other offense can be arrested. An arrest can occur for any other offense in the officer's presence except for traffic infractions or violations. Mm-hmm. What does that leave out? Wildlife offenses, boating offenses. Under the law, currently, an arrest can effectuate for that. Now, what the committee has before it in the Dash 10s and the Dash 11s are two alternatives. In the Dash 10s, the committee could remove the language from the law which would allow for an arrest for the wildlife offenses and boating offenses, and essentially say that for any infraction or any violation, that an officer can't arrest for that. The other alternative would be in the Dash 11s to leave the law as it is.
Mr. Chair.
But do what?
They could cite them.
Correct. A cite, of course, could still occur.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be clear. The original language in the current law says that an officer can basically arrest somebody for anything.
Not
except
quite.
For traffic infractions and violations.
No.
No. Okay.
No.
So I'm real wrong.
The current state of the law is as follows. A police officer, let's just talk about felonies. A police officer can arrest if he or she has probable cause for a felony, regardless of whether or not it is committed in the officer's presence. The same goes for a Class A misdemeanor. Now, under the law, an officer, if he has probable cause to believe that a Class B or Class C misdemeanor has occurred, if that Class B or Class C misdemeanor occurs in the officer's presence, the officer can arrest for that. He can also choose not to arrest and to write a citation out instead. If the offense is not committed in the officer's presence, then under the current law for Class B and Class C misdemeanors, the officer cannot arrest.
Oh, okay.
But a citation, of course, can occur.
I get it.
Now, and what changes are wrought by 10 versus 11? Both of them take out the restriction on misdemeanor arrest and allow arrest for a B or C misdemeanor outside of the presence. But then what's the next differentiation?
The only differentiation is on lines 19 and 20 of both sets of amendments. What line 10 would do is to provide that, well, let me make sure I get this right, I believe those would essentially provide that an officer could not arrest for any infraction or any violation. What the Dash 11 amendments do is would be to leave a provision in the law that says that an officer can arrest for any other offense in the officer's presence except for traffic infractions and violations.
So the irony is that right now the officer cannot arrest for a B or C misdemeanor unless it's been committed in the officer's presence, but the officer can arrest for a, say, a boating infraction?
That is legislative counsel's opinion, and I think the best way to state the law, as I understand it, is that that is probably up in the air.
Unclear.
It's very unclear, would be my interpretation of the law on that point.
Representative Pozanski.
Mr. Chair, where you do see a lot of situations where this arises is in the, more in the hunting violations where a game officer's out and that they could, in fact, and I would say that they would definitely be able to cite at any time. They would also be able to arrest if the violation or the offense was created or occurred in their presence. And you do see sometimes officers bringing some people in because of the, just the situation. My reading of this is it's basically going to remove that ability. And I think another thing that we need to keep in mind, I forget which bill, if it's actually coming to our committee,
Bill 20,
or if it's coming to civil. And that one there is basically going to collapse the definitions of infraction into the definition of violation. And so you're going to see some cleaning up. And so some of this is going to go away.
It would seem then that the Dash 11 amendment would be the cleaner route to take here. That is, you're leaving out traffic infractions and violations. You're leaving open the question as to arrest in other situations where they normally could issue a citation. But as you say, there may be a situation in the woods somewhere where a hunting violation has occurred and the officer may feel it's best to bring the person in.
Well, I think so. Ron Harder's here, but I think some of the hunting offenses may be unclassified misdemeanors, and that might be some that gets picked up. I'm not sure on that. Are they? Okay.
Well,
that's what I think it may be going, because there's some of them are just not designated, and you and that might be the ones that get picked up. But I don't see that much happening through my court.
Well, the chair would entertain a motion that we adopt the Dash 11 amendments.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Bowman moves adoption of the Dash 11 amendments. Is there further discussion? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash 11 amendments are adopted. Council, what are our other choices?
The committee has the Dash 13, 14, and 15. I don't see before me any Dash 12. We discussed the other day, Mr. Chairman, amending the crime of unauthorized entry into a motor vehicle, and the committee requested amendments back that simply provided that a person would commit the crime of criminal trespass in the second degree if the person entered or remained unlawfully, not only in or upon premises, but also in a motor vehicle. And that amendment is before the committee for its consideration, and that amendment would not involve any change to the unauthorized, unlawful entry into a motor vehicle statute.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question?
Sure, Representative.
Mr. Chair, currently, is there a law, attempted auto theft?
I can answer that. There is a Class C felony of unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, and there is the crime then of attempted unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, which is a Class A misdemeanor. Now, in most cases, if a person simply entered or remained unlawfully in a motor vehicle without doing more, it probably would not fit under that crime. Because in order to commit the attempted unauthorized use of motor vehicle, you actually have to try and take it, try and otherwise use it. And so it would be a really fact-specific scenario as to whether or not that would apply.
Do we have a rash of people breaking in cars sitting in them just to sit inside?
Do you want me to answer that?
Mr. Hort.
I want to be careful, Representative, about answering that because it's not appropriate for me to be either a proponent or an opponent of the bill.
It's
but
information just based on what you know.
There certainly are cases that I've seen in Multnomah County where a person would enter into a car, for example, to sleep in it.
Mm-hmm. And so is that not trespassing?
Apparently not.
Not under
not
the law.
Not criminal trespass.
Not now. That's what this would do, just make that. Mr. Chair,
go ahead, Representative Pozanski.
I can just give some examples, especially in university areas where there's a lot of transitorial traffic and people, let's say, without means sometimes are finding themselves looking for a shelter. And if there's a place to get out of the whatever, you may find them in the cars, and sometimes they do more than just that.
So, Representative Pozanski, do you move adoption of the Dash 13 amendments?
Yes.
President Brzezinski moves adoption of the Dash 13 amendments. Further discussion? Is there objection?
I'm surprised our creative district attorneys haven't interpreted that as using the vehicle for purposes of sleeping. It's still unauthorized use, unless there's a definition that you have to be moving it.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if the issues that I addressed the other day are still applied, because I can't really read the second page of the Dash 13 amendments, but I did raise the issue of getting into an automobile that you think is your own and you just don't know that, in fact, it's not yours. I don't know that this amendment actually dealt with that.
I do not believe it does.
Perhaps the word knowingly should be added.
Perhaps.
Let's check the words here.
I think that's the default.
Is it true that knowingly is the default provision in the mens rea of the criminal law? I'm getting a couple of nods there. So I think that the default, if we don't use a word in there, that you'd have to be knowing.
So the assumption would be that you knew that it was not your car.
Correct.
Okay. Got it. All right.
But we haven't done that. Excuse
you haven't done it yet. Is that different from what you want?
Well, let's go ahead. Reference to
I think the other thing about mens rea, if it's not in the actual charge and you don't prove it knowingly, recklessly, whatever it is, jail sanction is not available. So, you know, there's some other defaults there as well.
All right. All right. So, is there objection to adoption of the Dash 13? Seeing no objection, the Dash 13 amendments are adopted. And we're getting some clarification on the side here as to the Dash 8. Now, I think the 14 and 15 were dealt with in other legislation.
That's correct.
We can skip those. We have Dash 8. I don't have Dash 12s.
No.
Are there Dash 12s?
I don't have them yet.
Too late.
Whoever had the 12, this is your last chance. Dash 8s were from Representative Simmons.
And we had suggested that on line 17, where a period of 5 years is deleted and 1 year for first or second offense, that we stair-step that from 1 year for a first offense, 2 years for second offense, or permanently for any subsequent or a third offense. And we would need to conceptually amend that.
I think we can take care of this. Your proposal is to stair-step. First of all, I'd ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules for purposes of adoption of a conceptual amendment. Seeing no objection, the rules are suspended for purposes of adopting a conceptual amendment to an amendment. On the Dash 8 amendments, the conceptual amendment that I think Representative Simmons is offering here is to have it read, licenses on line 17, license suspended for a period of 1 year for a first offense, comma, 2 years for a second offense, comma, and permanently suspended for a third offense. That would be line 17 and 18.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think it's, instead of being a third offense, it should be any subsequent offense, because what happens on, I mean, if there's, I'm not saying there shouldn't be a fourth or fifth, but if there was.
I see what you mean. So go back to the original language here. So it would read instead, licenses on 17 and 18. License suspended for a period of 1 year for a first offense, comma, 2 years for a second offense, and permanently suspended for any subsequent offense. Is that what you wanted, Representative Brzezinski?
Well, I think that'd be clear, and what I think would be
the intent. It is the intent.
All right. So you moved the Dash 8 with that modification, Representative Simmons?
Yes.
Alex, we have that motion in front of us. Discussion on the motion. Representative Hansen.
Question. On the initiative that passed a couple of years ago, was the penalty prescribed in the initiative?
Representative Simmons, do you know?
I don't know for a fact that I believe it was. I have not read a copy of the initiative in any time in the recent several years.
I would assume that it was.
I think it was. I'll just look real quick.
It was, as noted at the bottom of the statute as it reads now, 498.164 was adopted by the people by initiative petition but was not added to or made part of the ORS 498, blah, blah, blah. This has no other changes to that initiative since it was passed. That was in 1995. That went into effect, so it was passed in 1994, the general election.
Further discussion? All right, then I'm going to ask for a roll call vote on the Dash 8 amendment as proposed with the modification already read into the record. Well, we'll pause for a moment. I'm going to invite up Mr. Fedenke because he's asking to be heard. Mr. Fedenke, go ahead.
I assume the chair is aware, but I assume this will be covered by Measure 10, Mr. Chair.
No, I do not think so. This is not a mandatory minimum sentence to imprisonment.
Yeah.
It's a license suspension. I thought about that, though. All right, we'll take the vote on the Dash 8 amendment as modified on the record.
Representative Gianella. Aye. Representative Hampton. No. Representative Simmons.
Aye.
Representative Simmons. Yes. Representative Pazonski. No.
Aye. The motion carries. The Dash 8 amendment is added to the bill. Are there any other amendments to 3374? Sorry about the choking here. We've adopted the Dash 8 with some modification. We've adopted the prior to the Dash 4 and the Dash 6 and the Dash 9 and the Dash, Dash 13 and Dash 11.
Actually, I have the committee unadopt this one.
Oh, we need to unadopt one?
Mr. Chairman, if the committee could unadopt the Dash 6s, it did vote on and adopt the Dash 6s, but those have been replaced now by the Dash 11s.
All right. I'd entertain a motion to withdraw the Dash 6 amendments from the bill.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
President Bowman, so moves. Is there a discussion on that? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash 6 amendments are withdrawn. Appreciate that.
I'm getting a hand signal from Mr. Lemon in the audience about the Dash 3s. Ah. If, because the committee, Mr. Chairman, adopted the Dash 9s, we also would need to unadopt the Dash 3s.
Take a look at the Dash 3s. What happens when we work with bills on separate days? Oh, yes. Let's double check. Yes, because we have what I'll call the Przanski fix to the Dash 3s, moving us into the Dash 9s. So, Representative Przanski, do you move that? And we probably implicitly rescinded the Dash 3s by the earlier motion, but let's be clear. Do you move to withdraw the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments, Representative Przanski?
Yes.
Representative Przanski moves withdrawal of the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the Dash 3 amendments are withdrawn. So I'll make a note of that, too. Any other amendments to be offered? Seeing none, do we have a motion? Do we have a referral to Ways and Means on this?
No, we do not, Mr. Chairman, and I don't believe that it needs to go to Ways and Means.
Because this is largely technical stuff.
Correct.
Double check here. We're not sending anyone to prison for 50 years or...
Just a few life sentences.
Some graffiti stuff here. All right, I'd entertain a motion. Representative Simmons, do you move that we send this bill as amended to the floor with a due pass?
Mr. Chair, I do.
All right. Collins, you've heard that motion. Discussion on the motion? Let's take a vote on that motion to send House Bill 3374 to the floor with the due pass as amended.
Representative Bowman?
No.
Representative
Powell?
Aye.
Representative Hanson?
No.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative
Ferry?
Aye.
Representative Pazonski?
No.
Aye. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I want to give notice of a possible minority report.
All right, we have notice of a possible minority report.
Mr. Chair, I will do the same.
All right, we have two of those. They're noticed. Motion is passed.
There's not enough members for three.
House Bill 3374 is sent to the floor with a due pass with a notice of a possible minority report.
Let that stop us.
And I'll assign myself as carrier on this bill. And let's
We have one left here, 2350. We'll move into work session on House Bill 2350. Council, where are we on this one?
Mr. Chairman, the committee has before the dash 2 and the dash 3 amendments. Please ignore the dash 1s. Those have been dealt with in another bill. I know that Mr. John Bradley is here on the dash 2 amendments, and I will defer to him and have him explain this.
And what about the dash 3s?
Mr. Chairman, I just first looked at these dash 3s, and I...
Why don't you look at them on Mr. Bradley?
That would be best if I could do that. Thank you.
Mr. Bradley, good morning. Welcome to the committee.
The number of the bill?
This is 2350.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Mannix, members of the committee. I'm John Bradley from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. Your dash 2 amendments, that's proposed by Michael Schrunk, who is the district attorney in Multnomah County. I'll also say this, that I talked to Jim Hennings yesterday, who's the public defender in Multnomah County. He said I could represent to you that he has no objection to this. I also talked to Doug Gray yesterday, who is the court administrator for Multnomah County, and he said I could represent to the committee that the Multnomah County Circuit Court supports this, especially the presiding judge. What this is in Multnomah County, we have a program called STOP, which is a program in which people go into, rather than ultimately end up with a conviction, they go through a drug treatment program, and if they're successful, at the end of that program, they don't have a record. Now, sometimes what we've done is, I think Multnomah County has one of the national programs in this, and I would say to this council, the STOP program has been in effect for many, many years in Multnomah County, and it's been one of the really successful drug programs we've had, and we've had many people come from outside the state to see this and see what we do. There is a funding problem, and what this will do is this will allow someone to plead guilty, someone to successfully complete the program, and at the end of the program, when they complete it, the case will then be dismissed, somewhat like it is today. The problem is the way they do it today is someone comes in, they stipulate to the facts, which means there's a stipulated court trial, but there's no finding of guilty at that time. The person then completes the program, and at the end of the program, when they've completed it, the case is dismissed. If, on the other hand, during the term of the program, the person, say, leaves, or the person reoffends, the judge then has the option to find the person guilty and then impose a sentence. And that's the sanction when somebody violates the STOP program. Because of the funding problem, and one of the things that's very, very important to the STOP program is to be able to be funded. And there has been a problem with the state as far as whether or not they will give money back to the program unless there's a guilty finding. Because what I said we do now is, and this is very, very technical, what we do now is we have someone stipulate to the facts, but there's no guilty finding, and then later on it's dismissed. What this would do is this would allow someone to come in to plead, and when they completed the program, to have the case dismissed.
Let me interrupt you for a moment since we're running short
okay.
of time. And we've got the public defender in support of this. We have the district attorney in support of this. We have the court in support of this.
What I said was this. I talked to Mr. Hennings last night. He said he had no objection
All right,
to it.
No objection.
Right.
Now, do I have anyone here today who is objecting? I do have the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and Kathy Osborne of Juvenile Rights. Mr. Vitenke. Okay. Let me see for a moment if members of this committee are comfortable that we might cut it a bit short here. We're in work session. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I'm ready to move it. The only thing is, and I know it's a great program from what I've heard before, is because of the upfront plea, whether or not it needs to go to Ways and Means, because of the potential impact of defense attorneys being appointed.
Do you have a comment on that?
Yes, I don't think it needs to go to Ways and Means for that, Representative Przanski. And the reason is because the public defender has a special contract, and this isn't supposed to alter that in any way.
Okay.
So there's not a cost thing.
You've got one person up there that might want to say something.
All right.
I did not talk specifically about that with him. What I'd make the suggestion is, if it does, and this goes to the Senate side, we can refer it at that time. I'm just thinking.
Let me ask you this. The deals are being made right now, but it's harder to get there from here.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to change the fact that the deals are made. We're just going to make it easier to get there from here.
Yes. In fact, the other thing is this. As Mr. Henning said, this is not necessarily his first choice. It's something that would be a fallback position.
And this is already after the charge has been filed.
Yes.
So we're not talking about a situation where people would not already have had right to counsel. That's a real question for indigent defense.
Well, what happens in Multnomah County is the drugs. These drug cases are much different than any other, because what happens is, even though the person is technically given an attorney, what happens is when somebody is stop eligible, they are turned over to the public defender's office. They meet with Robert, goes through the program with them. If they decide to participate in it, they then do it, and then you're not talking about the normal defense costs.
All right, what we can do is this. We'll have a couple other questions here. We won't finalize this bill today, just to make sure that we're clear about what the potential impact is. But we do have you here, and I'll ask if anyone else has questions for this witness.
Not for.
It has to be. And then what I'd like to do is at least adopt this amendment, and we can hold this bill while we also think about this other amendment, which has just come in front of us. Is there a motion, Representative Bowman?
I move the dash two amendments into House Bill 2350.
Representative Bowman moves adoption of the dash two amendments to House Bill 2350. Is there further discussion?
I just want to say for the record, Mr. Chair, that the STOMP program is phenomenal. I've seen it in action at Multnomah County, and the people who are presiding over that program really work with individuals, so I support this.
Very well. Representative Hansen.
Well, I'll second not only what Representative Bowman has said, but there's also an incredible spirit of cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
So if we've got the presiding judge, the district attorney, and consultation with defense people, they will make this work. And probably the biggest impediment right now to the STOMP program is funding. So
right.
Just on a straight faith, act of faith, I can support this and be enthusiastic because I know the people will make it work.
Very well. Is there any objection to the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments? Seeing no objection, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Thank you.
Why don't we give everyone a chance to look at these Dash 3s, and we'll hold them for the next time. What they do is they streamline the process for people who want to request criminal records. That statute hasn't been changed in 18 years. And it's a policy question as to whether you want to streamline them or not. That's if it's answered.
Mr. Chair, if I could change topics, I know that we're...
Sure. Well, now that I've just mentioned that, I'll close the work session and ask for 2350. Let's present. You want me in on another bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah, I'll call on 3374 that we did.
We will re-enter the work session and ask for 3374.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we could set this over until tomorrow to discuss. My concern is I know the chair doesn't think this is impacted by the Measure 10. My quick review, I believe it is, because we are actually changing the sentence that has been imposed by the people through the vote from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C misdemeanor. And my reading of Article 4, Section 33, gives me concern as to that moving forward.
All right. Well, what we'll do is we'll have 3374 on the agenda still tomorrow, and we'll note that and hold it. I won't sign any papers on it, and we'll take a look at it tomorrow.
So we'll open up tomorrow and discuss it when we all have time.
So we'll close the work session, House Bill 3374, and we are adjourned.
Great.